702 Masterclass.
It's 13 minutes past two. I've been such great anticipation for this conversation. You know, there are lost cities all over the world. Sometimes when you go to historic places, I'm always filled with the sense of wonder when you think that you are walking on ground that ancient people used to walk on, that maybe in a parallel universe, all of these contexts are existing parallel to one another. That's, of course, on a different thought of way of thinking altogether. But I'm always struck and I'm awestruck when I think of the millions of people, the thousands of people that have walked before us, particularly with where we stand today and what existed in that very same spot all those years ago. Well, WITS researchers have used a particular technology to recreate a very old city right here near Johannesburg. The city was first established, it's believed, in the 15th century. And until now, most of the ruins remained hidden under vegetation. And the site could only be imagined or imaged and sort of reconstructed the best way we know how using technology. And so we join my guest this afternoon, Karim Saad, who is a professor in geography, archaeology and environmental studies at WITS University. And he's been involved with his team in redrawing and giving us a sense of these remains of the Southern African city that was occupied all those hundreds of years ago. He gave a TED talk at TEDx Johannesburg. I know he only had, 12 to 18 minutes on the day, but there was just so much more that I wished we could unpack about this particular discovery that they've made and the process of rebuilding and putting together, bringing together all these pieces, building this puzzle of what was there before. And it's all thanks to technology. So with that, welcome, Professor.
Thank you very much, Azania. Thank you very much for the invitation.
How was that TED stage, by the way? Did you enjoy the platform?
It was, standing up there was a bit intimidating, knowing that you're being filmed and will be put online one day.
Yes.
But it was lovely. It was so well organized. I was very impressed.
Absolutely. I mean, you have you speak to auditoriums of young people. Mm. So I don't see how intimidating, why that was intimidating. Mm. But how did this project first come about? And how old or how long, how far back did it begin?
My part in it starts only about 10 years ago.
Yes.
But people have been working in that area since the 1960s at least. But my part was essentially I was looking for a job or a project that I could do on computers that wouldn't take me away from the office too long, because I was the head of school at the time and I couldn't get out too often.
Yes.
So, but on the weekends I used to go walking around in the Saker Bos Rand Nature Reserve, which I'm sure many people have gone and seen the ruins. There are many ruins there. You stumble over them left, right, and center. Mm. And I got interested in trying to figure out, well, what do these ruins represent? And gradually turned to Google Earth imagery, satellite imagery. And that got like 12 or 15 students together to help us work on that. Mm-hmm. And then eventually the money came in to do some LIDARs, this new technology scanning imagery,
yes,
which increased our view enormously.
Right.
And then from then, I just realized I got more work than I can do in two lifetimes.
that's exciting. That's absolutely exciting. You know, when you ask for something, and then when it does arrive, you think, ooh, I wasn't aware of what I was asking for, because it, as you said, it's going to take two lifetimes. Mm. So before, in the 60s, when the work began, was there just an understanding that there had been a community, that there was this metropolis there? Mm.
Well, the interesting thing is, you know, the ruins were never lost.
Okay.
In the sense that even the first European farmer who settled down there in 1860, before he built his own house, he camped out in one of these ruins. And that would make a fascinating project to dig that up.
Mm-hmm.
But the ruins, we know there were stone walls there. What was lost is the city. The sense that it was all one metropolis, one community. People in the 60s and 70s, colleagues in the 80s even, who were excavating there and working, were describing it as a series of villages or, you know, it didn't appear, and it's impossible to appreciate the fact when you're out there that you are standing in a metropolis. It's just invisible, surprisingly. And it's only this new technology that made it possible to see the whole thing, let's say.
Oh, that's just absolutely amazing. We will look at the technology in a short moment. Mm. But you had to cross-reference. You talked about how you had to cross-reference with other records, with other sources of information, historic records, to piece together the daily life of this community. What records did you have to look at?
There's a wonderful set of travel logs, travel journals, reports by early travelers, Europeans from the Cape Colony. We're now talking about 1800, so 217 years ago, who were sent up north into the interior of Africa by the governor of the Cape to essentially trade for cattle. That was the plan. And they, once they'd gone 2 months on the road way past the frontier, about 1,000 miles north of Cape Town, they ran into these huge settlements, which was very surprising for them because they hadn't expected that sort of thing. And so they gave descriptions of what they could. Now, these were not trained anthropologists or historians, and they weren't there really for doing this kind of work. So the reports are bits and pieces, but there are lots of interesting bits and pieces. And then later on, there were other expeditions that went there. And amongst them, there was a scientist, William Burkle, who went, and he was very well trained, and his descriptions are amazingly detailed. So, but these cities, some of them did call it cities. Many of them called them towns. Opinions differed. Metropolis comes up. City-states comes up. But these were all about 400 kilometers to the west of Johannesburg, where we are now. Later expeditions, some of them started moving this way, but none of them came closer than about 250 kilometers to Johannesburg before essentially a civil war has destroyed more or less all of these cities.
Yes.
Yeah. So their records are essentially, they tell us about meeting the king and how they were organized, the kind of places they lived in, the organization. It's all very impressive. They talk about parliaments. They talk about layers in the hierarchy, four or five classes in the social structure. So we get a lot of information about the people, very little about the objects, the city itself, the houses, the towns. And then so this discovery this far east was totally unexpected. Nobody had reported this place before.
Yes.
And there was no records, there's no oral memory, no oral histories of memory of this place. So, and this extends the range of this nation,
right,
this organization considerably.
So it's technology, the LIDAR, that allowed for you to have the information that you have today. So what is it? What exactly is LIDAR?
It's a wonderful toy. It's so complicated. I'm just a consumer, let's say. I'm not the technical end of it.
Yes.
But it stands for light detection and ranging. And the principle is very similar to radar that all the airports use, where they send out a radio signal. And that radio signal, as soon as it hits an airplane or a solid object in the sky, is bounced back. And because the speed with which it travels is known, the radio wave goes and comes back, and the amount of time it took tells the machine how far away that object is. So LIDAR does this with laser lights, and the object, of course, one can aim it at the sky, but for our purposes, a plane goes up in the air and bombards the landscape with really literally billions of pulses of laser light, which then, as soon as they hit an object, they bounce back, and it's recorded, and the precise position of that intercept is recorded in three dimensions. Now, it hits lots of birds and bees and trees and twigs and all that stuff that we're not interested in. So the technicians get rid of all that data for us and just keep what we call the last return, which is the light pulse that went the furthest and hit the bare ground before it came back.
Yes.
That's what we're interested in, is the bare ground. And then once we have all of these bare ground points, the technicians, again, they, let's say, stitch these together, they interpolate the data and create an image of the naked ground. No vegetation, no nothing except the ground and anything that's on the ground, rocks. So these stone walls, these ancient ruins just pop right out of this kind of imagery. You just see them as if they're on the surface of the moon.
Yes, the image that you shared looked like the lunar surface.
Very much so. It's a gray hillshade, because you can, of course, show it in different ways. It's just computer data.
Yes.
But that hillshade looks like a lunar landscape indeed.
Yes. And when you think of a lunar landscape, you can see the craters almost, and these circular structures that are also similar to what we see in your images. So what did that tell you about what was on the ground all those years ago?
What we were seeing were all the stone walls that the architects in this place, since about the 15th century, the tradition has been to build low stone walling to define the limits of the compound, to define the backyards of the houses, to define the cattle pens, and many other features. And these are stone walls without using any mortar, any cement, anything like that. They're just packed together very, very well, and they survived the ravages of time. The houses themselves would have been built of mud walls and thatch roof, traditional structures, and those are long gone. they're just decayed and gone. So we don't see those anymore, although they're, one can excavate the floors of them under the ground. But what this LIDAR imagery showed is essentially all of these stone walls, which are like the skeleton of this ancient city. So it gives us a good architectural view of how many homesteads, compounds there were, what kind of features, how big the whole thing was. But ultimately, in order to find out more, we still have to go on the ground.
Yes.
And so my students and we go off there as often as we can to get out of the office and look around. We just look around to see where are the doorways, where were the houses, where, you know, all the details that we can't see on the LIDAR imagery.
So the on the ground, with you walking that area, you're able to get a certain perspective. Mm-hmm. And then the plane through LIDAR gives you another perspective, and you bring those together.
Quite so, yeah. The LIDAR gives us a little bit... a good large-scale view, but to get the finer details, you need to be on the ground. Mm-hmm. So things like, for example, how tall the walls are, or have they been reutilized, robbed, and used somewhere else, the doorways, none of this shows up on the LIDAR itself. So it's on the groundwork. So for that, you know, nothing, and it's difficult because it's all covered in grass and vegetation and thorn trees. So you spend half a day sometimes just trying to crawl through these trees to get to a particular place where you can measure the doorway.
Yes.
So, but it's kind of fun.
But also, doesn't it add another kind of mysterious side to nature? Mm. Or it's a humbling part for us as human beings to see how nature also just reclaims. Mm,
absolutely, yeah. Yeah,
takes back what we had altered. Mm.
It's part of the life cycle of these ruins. I mean, some people would like to preserve these forever, but you know, I think they have a life cycle. They're built, they're used, and then they decay, and then they disappear.
Yes.
And one has to allow these things to happen. So fortunately, we caught this one before it's entirely gone. But so our job is to record as much of it as we can, basically.
Yes. So after that work has been done, what do we know about the dimensions, the layout of this particular metropolis?
At its height, and that would be about 1820, 1825, about 200 years ago, it's at about 10 kilometers long from north to south. It's composed of three main sections, and there's a bit of sort of open space between each of those sections. Mm. But it's 10 kilometers north to south, about 2 kilometers wide at the widest point.
Mm-hmm.
And in one corner where we don't have any LIDAR imagery yet, there might be a little bit more of it there. So I don't think we've caught the full extent of it. But I think, I mean, comparing this to some of the known ones from the early travelers, this is maybe the biggest one. It's very big anyway.
Mm. Mm. And how were they set up? What was the, you know, the town planning, if I can put it that way, for this metropolis?
Absolutely. It's a very well-planned town. The traditional layout of these Tswana capitals, from what I've read, is that you would have the royal section, the Khozing, would be the one in the middle, the sector in the middle, which is where the king and the royal family would live.
Mm.
And then there would be a northern sector and a southern sector.
Mm.
The northern sector traditionally was called the upstream sector, and the southern sector, the downstream sector, which fits perfectly the layout here at the Kweneng site, Sacred Bus Run, relative to the Klip River, which flows to the south.
Yes.
So that's the traditional layout. And then within each of these sectors, you have right in the center of the middle sector is probably where the king, the royal family, had their compounds. The meeting area, the plaza, where essentially the whole community would come on the king's order to listen to news, important things, decisions to be made.
Mm-hmm.
That's, we have found that. It's a very wide open space, very flat, beautifully placed right at the foot of a little hill. So I can just imagine the king going halfway up the hill and addressing thousands of his subjects. There are big cattle pens nearby. And then the northern sector and the southern sector, the architectural detail is a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
And often you had, for example, a whole sector of the city or wards within this, that sector could be occupied by foreigners or people who come from a different tradition, built in a slightly different tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those sectors, the northern one, for example, seems to have been the original nucleus where the, let's say, the village before the town, before the city took place.
Yes.
So it seems to have a longer history. So all of these details, I mean, we've just really just scratched the surface at the moment.
Yes.
But there's a lot of variety. The southern sector has a lot of roads. These are cattle drives, as far as we can tell. But now, why does the southern sector have all of them? The middle sector has some. The northern sector has very few.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the details we still have to work on.
Wow. Mm. What was the size of the population? Do we know how many people occupied the metropolis?
It's a very difficult guess. Even at the time when the Europeans visited the town, and they had the town in front of them. They had a lot of trouble guessing because, A, it's so big.
Wow.
You can't see it. You know, it's big.
Yeah.
And then they had to estimate, and walking around trying to guess how many houses there are. Widely ranging estimates. For one town, Litakoi, which is the first one that was visited, there's estimations from like 7,500 people to 24,000 people. So it's a very wide span. For archaeology, it's even more difficult because we don't know how many of those compounds were occupied at the same time. Some were already abandoned, maybe. So if one says at exactly 1805 AD, for example, how many people were there? It's a tough call. Ballpark figures is definitely more than 5,000. 10,000 is my guesstimate. It may have been more. I'm thinking this is a PhD project for a student next year to work it out. So.
This is ongoing work across two lifetimes, as the professor has said. You've been listening to the voice of Professor Karim Saad. He is a professor of geography, archaeology, and environmental studies at Wits University. And we're talking about ancient African or South African cities, but particularly focusing on the one that they've pieced together using this laser technology, LIDAR. So what questions do you have? It's just 400 kilometers away from Johannesburg. It's in the Sekerbosrand area in the nature reserve there. And with this team of students over the past decade or so, they've deployed technology, but also a lot of groundwork, hands-on work in understanding what this metropolis was like. So if you've ever wondered what was happening right here where we are, pre-colonial times, this, I think, gives us a great sense. So we'll take your calls on 011-883-0702 and 31702 for your SMSs. Your WhatsApps on 0727021702, all these numbers. So when we come back, we'll get a better understanding as well about who the people were that lived in this metropolis. 011-883-0702, 31702 for your SMSs for today's masterclass on African ancient cities.
702 masterclass.
It's 25 minutes to 3 o'clock and we're taking your calls, inviting your interaction and engagement as far as today's masterclass is concerned. And we're looking at ancient South African cities and been guided through this conversation by a professor of geography, archaeology and environmental studies at Wits University, Karim Saad. We're joined by TK now. TK, you're calling from Tsakane. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Azania. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, TK?
I'm good, but you know, I need to ask the professor here. Is he at Sekerbosrand? I don't know if I remember, but 3-4 questions for you. First, I don't know if they can transfer it from Department of Agriculture to Tourism, because those guys, to develop that place, I think the scientists can put it under tourism. It's a good potential to make, like I'm from Tsakane, it's 18 kilometers from me to go to Sekerbosrand. But for people around there to market that place under Department of Agriculture and Rural, it's not getting that place back to the map with that vibe. Yes, we do a lot of hiking there, but it's not that having that place. Then the second question, you see the marking they did at Sekerbosrand, point 1.2, the point 3 where you can see the cloud, where there was the old cloud and everything. There is no structure of those things anymore. If they can try to do an artificial thing that we can see and adapt to see, there was a building here. It was the place, like I think it's point number 7, where you can, by the dam, when you can look the other side to see the Joburg side, you can't see Joburg.
Okay.
Yeah.
So those are the two. I'm still waiting for 3 and 4, TK.
Oh. The other question is, if they can, as the professor, I don't know if their equipment, because I've seen they are putting electronic equipment, the white in color, when they disturb the environment of those animals that are that size.
Okay, all right. TK, thank you very much. You seem to know the area very well.
No, I hike there a lot. We've been planning going this weekend for the last hike for the year.
For the year. Nice. Nice. As a fellow hiker, maybe I should come along. TK, thank you for the call. That's TK in Tsakane, but let's look at some of the pointers, and I'm not sure if it is your scope of if it is your area, but ultimately maybe you have views on it. he wants this to be he's saying it should be turned into a tourism attraction. Mm-hmm. It's already a nature reserve. Mm-hmm. What is the status mm-hmm. of the spaces that you've excavated?
Yes, no, that was a wonderful set of questions by TK. He's very well informed, and it's wonderful to speak to someone who knows the area. Mm-hmm. He's absolutely right. The nature reserve is run by the Gauteng Department of Agriculture and Rural Development, and their main mission is to look after nature. It's the animals and the plants that they're really excited about. And the ruins are there, but they, for example, they don't have an archaeologist on staff. Mm. There are over 1,000 ruins, and nobody's there to really do much about it. Well, they do have a staff member who's a trained anthropologist with some archaeological training, and he's done what he can. He's done a great job with a little museum there, mm-hmm. but much, much more can be done. And maybe the Department of Tourism is the right way to go. I don't know. I mean, it's for the government to decide. We are certainly trying to, once we've mapped the site, and there's a paper coming out early next year, I hope, or by the middle of next year, on sort of the technical report of the site itself. And on the strength of that, I'm hoping to approach the South African Heritage Resource Agency and see if they can maybe class the site as a national resource, right. which would then allow all kinds of other things to happen in terms of making it more accessible, perhaps. Mm-hmm. It's very well protected as it is, but it's not, as TK says, it's not signposted. It's not. Mm. Then again, signposting these things is difficult. The maintenance is costly. There's always fires. We're looking at ex-student of mine is working, doing a wonderful job of digital reconstruction. And he uses gaming software and all kinds of things that I don't understand to recreate the way these things were in the past as a digital video. And one could perhaps have QR codes or barcodes around that people with smartphones could tag into, yes. and see these things online. So there are many ideas, and some of these will become PhD projects again, yes. for some students to figure out how to do it. But it's a costly thing. To reconstruct physically and to signpost physically is a huge expense. And the maintenance is very huge. So whichever department eventually decides to do it, they're going to have to think very long and hard about how to make it pay for itself.
Mm. What do you think of the idea of reconstruction?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's been tried with other ruins in different places to reconstruct, to build it up. For example, in Melville Kopjes, mm-hmm. there's one that was rebuilt, I think, in the 60s or the 70s, cleaned up, and it's still there, and it's wonderful. And there is but the place is very well protected with a fence. So, you know, you reconstruct, but it falls apart again. So it would be nice to reconstruct one, say, compound as a physical, something that people can walk through. Mm-hmm. But again, it's more the expense and the upkeep. It's easy enough to do it the first time around, and it's been tried several times in different places. But then over the years, the cost of upkeep, maintenance is serious. It's not true.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And I guess if it is a tourist attraction, mm. or if it's preserved and so, or gets some kind of status, mm-hmm. it's protected, mm. and then can be self-sustained, mm-hmm. through tourism.
Absolutely, yeah.
And a space that we can respect.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just be clear, because as you were saying during the break, there is Seker Bosrand, but there are all sorts of ruins in the area, mm-hmm. in general. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Melville Kopjes, mm-hmm. Is the one in the south of Johannesburg, Leetago?
No, the one south of Johannesburg, that's the Seker Bosrand, which we've been working
Kwenning.
On. Yeah, Kwenning, yeah.
That's
Kwenning. So that's only 30 kilometers from here, practically. It's a very easy drive.
Mm.
Leetago is the first one that the Europeans visited from the Cape, and that's 400 kilometers to the west of us, very, very far away.
Yes.
Between Leetago and here, we know of at least maybe half a dozen to a dozen other such ancient pre-colonial capitals. Some of them are in Botswana.
Mm-hmm.
But when we read these ancient reports, we can tell they're talking about there are at least twice as many of these cities around the. Some of them we don't know yet, so
yes.
they're hidden by the trees, I guess. So, but this one, Kwenning, is very close. It's right next to us here.
What does it tell us then? Because have you and the team, I guess, thought about what it tells us about this part of the country, mm-hmm. all those years ago in pre-colonial mm-hmm. times?
Mm. Yes, absolutely. I mean, There's been a lot of misinformation, obviously, in the previous regime, and in the school books that taught that there was nobody here when the Europeans arrived. So all of that, obviously, is not true. The school books today, I just bought a copy of the seventh grade social studies book, which is where they talk about these things. And the amount of information that's given is minimal. Mm. So there's so much more information that is... known to archaeologists, known to historians, is in the libraries, but it's really buried for the general public. They can't access this kind of information. Mm-hmm. So we really need to do a much better job of informing people about these ruins. It tells us a huge amount about how complex this civilization was here before the civil wars, which really disrupted everything, closely followed then by the arrival of the Europeans who took over. So there's a hidden history there that needs to be brought to the public.
Yes.
We know a lot of it, but again, a lot of it is so poorly known in general that it has to come out. And then the details are poorly known to us as well. For example, why did the Tswana who lived in the Sekebosran here and this area too, in the 15th century, they were at that time, 500 years ago, they were living in small compounds quite far apart from each other, very dispersed sort of subsistence level farmers. And over the next 200 or 300 years, they came together and decided at some stage to live in an urban setting. Now, we don't know why. Mm. You know, why do humans, not only here but elsewhere in the world, why did humans decide to become an urban population? I read that in the year 2007, which is now, 11 years ago, more than half of the world population became urban. And 10,000 years ago, there were no cities on this planet. You know, so after a million or more or less a very long history of the human species, suddenly within 10,000 years, which is less than 1% of our history, suddenly we decided that it's a good idea to become an urban city. Why?
Yes, yes.
And it brought all these problems.
And yes, that's when we have to come up with the governance systems around how you govern a society like that.
It's not a simple thing, you know, and the logistics are horrendous. And Kweneng, the beauty of it is it's a very recent case of developing urbanism. It's very well preserved. The information is right there. We can use historical documents. We have historical linguists. We have anthropologists to help us. So it's a wonderful laboratory to try and understand why did we do this. Elsewhere in the world, the earliest city is in Mesopotamia and current Iraq. And that was born, let's say, something like 6,000 or 7,000 years ago, and the information is so poor, so decayed. Mm. And anyway, who wants to go? You can't work there; it's a war zone anymore. Mm. So you know, those ancient cities cannot really tell us nearly as much as Kweneng can tell us about this global question: why urban?
Yes. You know? In your TED talk, you highlighted certain structures, and I know that you worked with archaeologist Professor Revel Mason, mm-hmm. who's carried out a lot of research mm-hmm. when it comes to stone wall structures, mm-hmm. and he contributed to some of your work. Mm-hmm. So that's one aspect of it. But they were these structures that you were saying it was hard to understand what they were. Were mm-hmm. they grain bins mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. were they for storage? Mm-hmm. Can you describe mm-hmm. those?
Yeah. There are many, many features in this built environment, architectural features and other things, which don't seem to exist beyond Kweneng. So,
I see.
So they haven't been encountered before.
Or so not they could be innovations that are specific to...
You know, that's one question is where do these innovations come from and where did they spread and why did they become popular? And these grain bin bases that you talked about, these are stone tower or platforms, 2.5 meters tall, 5 meters in diameter, solid rock. I mean, lots and lots of big stones. Mm. An enormous amount of labor to put these things together into this conical tower. And, well, we think maybe grain bins on top, but it's by no means proven. Some people think they might be marking the graves of very important people. That's something to be tested. The only other place we know in southern Africa where people build towers is in the Great Zimbabwe culture. And so we're thinking, is there a connection? You know, that's much earlier than Kweneng. Or if it's not a connection, then why did they innovate this here? Neighboring sites have small, low platforms for grain bins.
Yes.
But it's not the 2 meter tall. So, you know, what's behind these things? So that's another PhD student's job next year. There are also these enormous monumental ash heaps, middens, which are about signaling power.
Yes, I remember taking a note to say the rubbish dump of the day.
It's a neat idea. And again, that's very rare in the other Tswana capitals. They have rubbish dumps. They're not big, they're not monumental, and they're not positioned to show off, basically showing off. And in the beginning, when they start out, of course, they're small and nothing to see. But the more wealthy the head of that household, the more feasts he throws, the more cattle he slaughters, the more beer pots break and get tossed out onto this dump, the more activity there is in that household, consumption, the more of it ends on this ash heap in front of the household on the way in, practically. And it grows and it grows and it grows. And eventually it becomes a monument over which visitors have to walk up these steep inclines and arrive into the compound huffing and puffing from the exertion. Some of them are very big. There's one that's 7 meters tall to
wow.
go over. Yeah, this is there. And they're very beautiful. The urban planning, the landscape architecture there is stunning. Everything's placed with a view to who could see it and who could not see it.
Yes.
So everything's planned very well. And these middens are, you know, you get them in some parts of the world. In Nigeria, they have some in southern India, but from many, many thousands of years before quenning. So one wonders, again, an innovation. Who thought of it? Why is it here? Where does it come from? Is it a local development? I was walking around a game park the other day, and the ranger told me about these springbok or antelope middens. They're dung patches. And I didn't talk to him about these ash middens, but he was saying that essentially the bigger the antelope herd, they use the same spot for their toilet, and they mark their area by creating these toilets. And the more there are, the more powerful that herd of animals,
wow.
the more numerous, the bigger their dung heap. And that's a signal to, let's say, a young buck who comes in and says, can I take on the alpha male of this herd?
He
just has to look at that dung heap and say, whoa, maybe this is too big for me.
Yes, yes.
So you know, they're signaling as well by the size of their heap. So it's, you know, the ideas around in nature and in culture as well. And Johannesburg, we're ringed with these gold mine dumps, which all the tourists who come visit me, visitors, they fly, what are those great big yellow hills? That's the wealth of Johannesburg.
Yes, I also had to answer that not too long ago, in fact. So let's take another break. If you have any questions about South Africa's ancient cities, do give us a call. We're in conversation with Professor of Geography, Archaeology and Environmental Studies, Karim Saad. And he gave a great talk at TEDx Johannesburg. Can't wait for those to be available online so you can see the range of speakers and what they had to say. So he was sharing insights about the exploratory work that they've been doing around all of these different sites that give us a sense of what was here before we were here around pre-colonial times.
702 Masterclass.
Yes, we're in the throes of a masterclass looking at ancient African cities, South African cities to be precise. And we're taking your calls today as we're in conversation with Professor Karim Saad, a Professor of Geography, Archaeology and Environmental Studies at Wits University. Tony, good afternoon. You're calling from Witbank. Hi.
Yes, hi, Zanya. Thanks for a fascinating topic. I'd just like to ask the prof, to me it's fascinating that sort of the biggest city in that area only had about 5,000 to 10,000 people. It just shows how the world's population, not just South Africa, but around the world, has exploded.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to ask him, you know, if he says it came to a sudden end in around 1820, how do they know this? Is this from archaeological evidence or from literature? And what caused those civil wars that sort of destroyed that culture or that civilization? I find that fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tony. And that does lead us to the last section of our conversation. So what led to the demise?
Yes, very good point that Tony raised. The civil wars, it's been studied on its own right by many, many historians and so on. So as far as we can tell, the cause of the civil wars, I think, ultimately was climate change. And it caused drought, it caused problems all around. Everybody was hungry, and a lot of people were taking food from their neighbors, who were then taking it from everybody else. So it has a knock-on effect.
Mm-hmm.
It was compounded by the fact that the European colony at the Cape was expanding. The frontier was coming forward, which caused all kinds of turbulence on its frontier. And there are those who argue that the Europeans were here also because there was climate change and they needed to get more resources. And then in the southeast of the country, there was Shaka Zulu's empire was rising and expanding. So that was also putting pressure on the frontier that was then sort of domino style causing problems further inland.
Mm-hmm.
So civil war, everybody against everybody, and really an uncertain time, not a very nice time to be around probably.
Yes, yes.
So what we know that it laid waste to a lot of these cities. For the ones in the west, where the missionaries and the European travelers described it. So they might have come, say, in the 1820 and said, wonderful city, etc., and came back 5 or 10 years later and said, ruins, nothing but dead people. Mm. So we know some eyewitness, not exactly eyewitness account, but at least a before and after view. But then there's a lot of memory, a lot of oral histories in different populations who suffered and who have lots of oral stories about what happened, when, where, who was. Mm. And so historians have been able to recreate in some detail what really did take place. What affected Kwaneng particularly was a warrior king from KwaZulu-Natal, King Mzilikazi, who led the Matabele or the Ndebele population. And he had to escape KwaZulu-Natal because for some reason there was some disagreement with Shaka and he was in danger. So he took a couple of hundred apparently soldiers with him. But along the way he assimilated other populations and became bigger and more powerful as he went along. He went far to the north and then at some point decided to come back south. And he came to the Sekebosrand area. Mm-hmm. He built a capital just on the other side of Heidelberg, so that's about within 24 kilometers of Sekebosrand. Mm. And it appears that he burnt down Kwaneng, or there was warfare. We know this because there are lots of evidence of burned houses there. So we know something happened now, whether that is exactly what happened or not. Other historians say, yes, there was warfare, a lot of refugees, bad times. But there were also populations who agreed to become his subjects. So they were not killed. They were simply... So it's possible that some of the populations of Kwaneng stayed there.
Yes.
No longer as a glorious city, no longer as an independent polity, but as subjects of King Mzilikazi.
Yes.
And that's as best as we can tell. We need to now do the archaeology to see if we can figure out which parts were destroyed and which parts may be continued under occupation into...
So,
times.
Are the present day Bakwena the descendants of the people of Kwaneng?
Yeah, the Bakwena is a very large group, a Maraf that has many, many parts from historical splits between this and the other group. In fact, the most furthest Tswana-speaking group towards the Kalahari is also a Bakwena group in Botswana. So, but the Bakwena population here, there's two subdivisions who are here at the two branches. At the time before the arrival of the Europeans, this is reconstructed by oral histories again. There's one group who are known in the literature as the Bakudu, and another group who are known as the Bapohole Bamare. Yeah. And the Bapohole descendants are here. They're very well organized. I managed to make contact with them through one of my PhD students who was very good, lucky to find them, I think. Mm. And it's been a wonderful relationship. So they're very happy about this find. And I think their idea that it's their ancestors who built this place is certainly a very valid one, a very likely one.
Yes.
The Bakudu population, from what I can tell, they seem to be no longer here. And the people I spoke to among the Bapohole, they think they might have been wiped out largely by Mzilikazi, or they were refugees and gone elsewhere. But on the maps, it looks like this Kwaneng city is in the area that was under the occupancy of the Bapohole. They are still here.
Yes, yeah. Interesting. And I wonder what someone like Professor Freddie Kunoo would say, because he wrote a book as well documenting the Bakwena Bamokhopa movement. Mm. So I wonder what he would think. Mm. Mountains of Spirit, I think the book was entitled. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
It's a great pleasure, Azania. Thank you very much. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here.
We look forward to more revelations. As you said, your two lifetimes will be dedicated to this.
Let's hope. Fingers crossed. Hope,
absolutely. We piece together what is absolutely fascinating. Mm. I mean, in my mind's eye, I remember listening to the professor give that TED talk and using the images he had on screen. You allow your imagination to run about what was here before we were here. It's incredibly humbling. Thank you, Professor.
It's a great pleasure.